It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the spring statement, a new strategy for UKRI and social mobility. It's all coming up.
Than students might necessarily be. So even if they think, oh, we don't care, you know, these are just costs that students and or new graduates are going to have to bear. The reality is that cash gets filled from somewhere else and from someone else, and that is going to hurt politically.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and joining me are three brilliant guests as usual to help unpack the week's goings-on in HE. In Hertfordshire, it's Andy Westwood, Professor of Government at the University of Manchester. Andy, your hire to the week, please.
Oh, well, morning, Mark. My highlight is probably yesterday. I spent most of the day in Oldham, where we launched an economic review of Oldham, which we've been working on for about the last 6 or 7 months with the council and with Alan Francis, who's the chief exec of the local FE college. So that was all really good fun, actually.
In Chepstow, it's Jenny Shaw, Higher Education External Engagement Director at Unite Students. Jenny, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. Well, you know how much I love a podcast, so my highlight of the week has actually been how much podcasting I've managed to fit in this week. So as well as being on The Wonky Show, which I always love, I've also been guest presenting Accommodation Matters, and I've even managed to fit in my own podcast as well. So it's been audio heaven for me this week.
And in Islington, it's Sunday Blake, Wonky's Associate Editor. Sunday, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was going to the UK Policy Away Day, and they're doing some really fantastic work and looking at some really progressive policy developments. But they also had homemade lemon drizzle cake, which was a really nice touch.
So let's start with the spring statement. Andy, talk us through the highlights or the lowlights.
Yeah, well, there are more of the latter than the former. I should start by saying kind of the spring statement is the lesser of the two big fiscal events of the year. So,
and it still sounds wrong to say, doesn't it, the spring statement, because it was always the autumn statement and the budget in the spring. And this does make more sense to do it this way around, but it doesn't roll off the tongue, the spring statement.
No, and it doesn't, however much you might think it's worth having a sort of lesser, smaller one, which is just an update, which is what this is meant to be. Events, not least at the moment around the world, kind of conspire against you, and it means that sort of a small, thinnish update suddenly looks quite inadequate when you look at all the things that people are confronted with, you know, whether that's in the kind of tensions globally around Ukraine and its consequences, or the not unconnected cost of living crisis at home. So there's always a real worry that kind of, you know, however much you want to plan what you're going to tell the world or what you're going to tell the country about your fiscal plans, that doing a deliberately sort of smaller, briefer one isn't going to quite fit the demands of the time. And I think that's definitely been the case with yesterday's event. And I think it was very notable that very, very quickly, even amongst the newspapers and media and columnists that would typically support the kinds of approaches that Rishi Sunak set out, were pretty critical pretty quickly. So I think it's not going down that well, but it had a lot to try and confront. I mean, the headlines are, you know, 5p off a litre of fuel, which doesn't really go hugely far in any sort of sense, and the plan to take a penny off income tax in 2024. So if nothing else, we can all set our diaries for May 24 as the time of the next general election. So that's something we can kind of note. I guess the most interesting things for us from a higher education perspective actually go back to the lecture that Rishi Sunak gave, the Mays lecture a couple of weeks ago, where he really sort of set out his own kind of take on the economy and where it's weak and where it should go, and kind of focused on these three ideas of capital, people and ideas. And he riffed a bit on that in the spring statement yesterday and landed in two very specific areas that might only be seen as peripherally interesting to the kind of higher education community, but are actually directly very interesting and will be something that we need to watch out as they do the work. The first is the expansion of R&D tax credits or the review and expansion. So they're going to fine tune those. And government spending on that has gone up and up and up, but the actual impact on employer spending has been pretty negligible, and compared to rest of the OECD, businesses still spend a lot less on R&D than other countries. So how that gets reformed come the autumn will be very significant. And then the other, not unconnected, is the promise to reform tax arrangements to support more employee training. Now, a lot of the headlines say that's about the apprenticeship levy, and that's obviously a central part, but it's not the only part. What Sunak diagnoses both in the May's lecture and in the spring statement is that we don't do enough of that either, very low compared to other countries, and that's, you know, if you want to get capital people ideas sorted, you've got to get that functioning. So he's going to put more effort into what the tax arrangements are that support that. Interestingly, not a lot of mention of the lifelong loan entitlement or the policy that we might have spent most time thinking about. And so I think it's quite interesting to see how he talks about R&D and how he talks about adult skills. And they're very different. They're very different to the way BEIS or UKRI talk about R&D. They're very different to the way that universities talk about R&D. And the same really goes for all the adult training stuff. You know, we tend to think it's going to come in the form of a lifelong learning set of policies. And actually, he's starting from the tax system and from firms. So some really interesting areas for us to sort of think about, well, what does that mean for us, as well as what does that mean for those different areas of policy that we're perhaps more familiar with. So we'll find out in due course.
Fascinating. And I mean, one of the other part of the criticism of the statement has been about its failure to deal with the cost of living crisis, isn't it? And there is clearly going to be a crunch on students. I mean, graduates, the other kind of the flip side of the statement was the fiscal headroom that the Chancellor had to make the changes that he made, the headline changes. A lot of that turns out to be on the back of making graduate repayment much more punitive, the stuff that was announced back at the Augur response a few weeks ago. So we've got a bit of a squeeze coming, haven't we? We've got a less fair deal for graduates and then students who are going to be hit quite hard by this cost of living crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's already hitting students. It's already hitting higher education. And that's absolutely exacerbated by the rise in inflation. And that's probably the other big theme of the spring statement, that it's expected to peak at 8.7%. I mean, these are levels of inflation that we've not seen since the 70s. But the average this year is going to be 7.5%. Now, all of that means that whether it's students' money or the repayment arrangements are going to get harder and tougher very quickly. But of course, it also means that that the university's income, and you think back to the kind of freezing of the fee for the rest of the parliament, that inflation at that rate is going to rapidly erode the value of the fee, which obviously ties universities' hands to spend money on all sorts of different things, whether it's teaching and learning or pensions or whatever else they want to.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I call it a double whammy. It's actually a triple whammy, isn't it? Because you've also got you've got students with less money paying more back over their lifetime for a less good experience, because universities are going to have less money spent. I mean, Sunday, Jim's analysis on the site this week is really interesting, isn't it? Because he kind of identifies that squeeze. And the other thing, you know, people forget that you know, many students will be classified as low income, and that because of their basket of goods, they're going to be hit really, really hard by inflation.
Yeah, I mean, so I would recommend reading both DK and Jim's pieces on the site, just to like get a really good orientation of how this is impacting students and graduates. Obviously, you know, things like 5p of fuel, you know, DK makes the point that, okay, some students have cars, but not many. And as for graduates, well, most graduates live in inner cities. You know, there's even no point in having a car. You can't afford a car. But I think the thing with the cost of living in young people is that I feel like at the moment, everyone's assuming that it's a sort of individual detriment. So this idea of like young people having to tighten their belts a little bit, you know, maybe cook more at home. You know, there's that kind of trope of the avocado on toast or whatever. But actually, this is going to have like serious implications on things much further afield than just the sort of individual's luxuries. Because if you put this into the context of the pandemic, and I don't want to say post-pandemic because I think we're still sort of navigating it, but, you know, obviously we do have more at-home jobs and, you know, the potential for more lockdowns or restrictions means that young graduates or graduates will be working at home. And what I've seen is a lot of people having to access their working space within their homes, but their homes are shared housing or not the most optimal space in which to work. And that's because obviously they're trying to save money and graduates can't work in houses of 6 or 7 25-year-olds, right? Especially if they're in loud built up areas. And I feel that this is being made out to be a sort of individual cost of living, but this will have repercussions on like lots of things, on output of work for organizations, on performance, on retention rates, on knock-on time and money spent on recruitment. You know, when we talk about a cost of living in a pandemic or post-pandemic world, we're not talking about the space that people go home to. We're talking about the space that a lot of critical work is taking place that upholds the country and the economy. So it's not just, oh, well, graduates are going to have to maybe not take a holiday this year. It's that we've got an infrastructure set up where people need to pay to have space in their home environment that graduates can't afford to like attain and work in. So the sort of siphoning off of, oh, well, this is hitting graduates and it's hitting them, you know, in terms of like having to pay a bit more. That is true. And obviously, like, I feel that there should be sort of solidarity there, but it is going to have knock on impacts like across the country in wider ways.
Jenny, I don't want to tiptoe around the point that, I mean, you work for one of the largest student accommodation providers in the country. And I know you've got kind of broader concern of about students and their experience and their well-being. But I mean, are you worried about how students are going to afford accommodation on the basic level?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a wider position here. And I think like Sunday, the thing that really stood out to me was that sort of generational effect. So I think that's the wider context. We've got some data from the NUS, some new data from the NUS about the student cost of living and some really alarming stats in there. And I think it is concerning that there's been no review of the student maintenance package, despite the recommendations and the Augar review, and that the planned rises in the package are not going to keep pace with the cost of living. In terms of accommodation, well, I suppose there's, you know, students want and students deserve to have, you know, a good quality, well-maintained, safe environment. And, you know, there is going to always be a sort of minimum cost to be able to do that and, you know, to do it in a non-damaging way to the planet and do it in a way where you pay your staff fairly. So, there's a point below which you can't go as an accommodation provider. And it is a systemic issue. It's not something that, you know, anyone can address on their own, but it's very much on everyone's minds within the accommodation sector. I know that.
And what should universities be doing specifically? The question to all three of you.
I think one of the interesting things about the politics of all of this, of course, the impact on students is very, very significant, and the impact on universities, as I say, from that declining value of the fee and other sources of income. I keep thinking back to that slide that Mark Corver presented at your recent Wonky conference, where he showed if you modelled the value of the fee in real terms at the sorts of inflation rates that we're now beginning to get used to, it disappears south very, very quickly. So you know, all of those long term plans that universities, or even medium term plans, you know, are pretty worthless. But I also think that, I mean, the politics of the budget and the next election, of course, is that whether it's accommodation or additional costs of study, because those costs don't go away, it falls on largely on kind of parental contributions or on students having to do other things. And so it hits other people too. And you might think that those are more likely to be in the target voting markets for Conservative governments than students might necessarily be. So even if they think, oh, we don't care, you know, these are just costs that students and or new graduates are going to have to bear, the reality is that cash gets filled from somewhere else and from someone else, and that is going to hurt politically.
I do wonder if there's room for transparency around the cost of living in in student recruitment, because one of the things that I get quite frustrated about when we're talking about students' cost of living or just like how expensive it is to go to university, and you know, some really difficult decisions that students have to make around the source of their income, and one thing that frustrates me a lot around how much it costs to go to university is the sort of relentless focus on fees, which, you know, for the large part of students going to university, that is something that they are paying off after university. It's not something that they're sort of going to work and earning money for and balancing their studies. You know, that's all about the cost of living. And it's really funny because if you're looking to move somewhere and you're looking at like a flat, right? And it says the cost of rent, but then underneath it has like, you know, the bills and the council tax, and it says all the figures there. And as far as I'm aware, that's not something that students really get given, like when they're making decisions around like where to live and which institution to go to. And I don't think that I wouldn't advocate that as a good way of matching up candidates with institutions, like at all. But it's almost getting to the point where you feel like that should be happening, because it's so that the applicant can make like the most informed decision around where they go. I don't want that to ever be the situation that we're in, but at the moment, it feels like that's the best way. That's the fairest option for the current situation that we're in.
Yeah, I really liked Jim's analysis on the blog this morning, where he sort of differentiated between just about getting by as a student and, you know, the sort of the quality of life that helps you get the most out of your experience. I thought that was really important, because debates about this tend to be a little bit black and white, a bit, you know, either students are being profligate with their money, and I think Sunday you mentioned avocado on toast and all that sort of thing, or you know, they're sort of in poverty. And I think that middle band around, you know, having a good quality experience where you're going to get the best from your time is really important. I wanted to come back on the point that you mentioned, Andy, as well, about parents and parental contribution, because it is a feature of our system within the UK that parents are expected to contribute. I just wanted to say that we've got some polling coming out quite soon on not just students and cost of living, but also their parents as well. So I think that's going to shed some interesting light on that.
On the politics, I mean, one of the things that continues to get my goat, and it really has done in the last couple of months more than it has for a long time, is this sort of lack of honesty in the political arena about how we treat students and graduates. And when the government keeps changing the kind of the levers on the dial with things like graduate repayments, and particularly now how it's, you know, extended to 40 years, so essentially your entire working life, you know, it behaves, it kind of looks like a graduate tax. And the Treasury is kind of using it in that way as well. So we'll raise taxes on graduates to pay for, you know, money off, you know, pensioners' fuel costs or whatever. But they don't ever frame it that way. And what's really dishonest about this is that it is a political choice. And, you know, by any sensible measure, the Chancellor needs to, you know, when he's on his feet at the dispatch box, needs to say, well, you know, this year we're going to be prioritising pensioners, and I'm afraid to say that means, you know, it's going to be a tough times for graduates. But then we find that out in the Red Book afterwards. It's never ever framed that way. But it's, you know, it's essentially, it's almost like they think no one's going to notice, but they do. I mean, it's in every single newspaper. The IFS mentioned it. It's in the FT. I mean, you know, it is noticed by people who pay attention to these things, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the dishonesty also like extends to, you know, when the Department for Education is making sort of big statements around student mental health. And I sort of think, you know, it's not students notice it, you know, students are the ones reading the newspapers and seeing the headlines around the impact it's going to have on them. And I don't understand where this kind of like detached thinking has come up, where, you know, universities have to be doing lots to help student mental health, but, you know, puppies and student unions and extra wellbeing appointments are only going to go so far when you're studying under a system that essentially you've signed up to a extra lifelong tax and you need to make that worth your while. And the absolute like strain and stress that you're under, especially if you come from a disadvantaged background, like that is going to have an impact on your mental health, like beyond like almost anything else, like that the absolute pressure that students are under. You know, there is so much pressure for students to get a first class degree. And then it's not just good enough to have a first class degree. You also have to have a master's. And in fact, it's not just good enough to have a master's. You have to have a distinction in your master's, you know. And it's sort of, I sort of sit here thinking, how can you make these statements around student mental health while simultaneously crippling that mental health under such like a pressurized system to make the most out of a lifelong tax that you're going to be paying off for the rest of your working life? Like, I don't think that they quite appreciate, or maybe they do, they just won't publicly acknowledge the absolute stress that people are under that system.
Andy, do you think this would be better if the Chancellor had to stand up and set fees and graduate repayment levels and all the rest on an annual basis on budget day or in the spring statement or wherever?
Yeah, I think it would be. And I think if we think back to when the foundations of the current system were set, that was the intention, or something pretty close to that. And I think it does sort of push. At one level, it just shows that over the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 40 years, the government is going to fund less higher education than it had in the past. Inflation's going to make that even less. So other people or things are going to have to step into that gap. Now, of course, for lots of people and for lots of students, there is nothing to step into that gap. And that's where some of the real pressures and tensions come in. But at one level, you can imagine them being quite honest about that, saying, "Well, we don't want to spend more money on higher. We spend too much. We want to spend less. That's a good thing. The state has a reduced role in lots of things, and that's a fundamental kind of conservative view that Rishi Sunak set out in the Mays lecture." So at one level, you can imagine them being relatively transparent about that, but rather less transparent, and it does mean it's much more subject to sort of the smoke and mirrors of how you choose to present these things at the time. It absolutely doesn't kind of set out those issues or the government's position in those issues. And it really tries to sort of disguise it by kind of not admitting that they exist and that the impact is as significant as it is. Now, whether you're an 18, 19-year-old in your first year or thinking of going off to university this year, or whether you're the parent of that 18 to 19 year old or the employer of that 18 to 19 year old, you know, this has a massive impact on all of you. You know, we may as well be honest about it even if government isn't being.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Felicity Mitchell, the independent adjudicator for higher education. As you might expect, the subject of my blog is student complaints. I've been looking at what the OIA has been seeing as we approach the second anniversary of the first COVID lockdown. I look at the sometimes bumpy return to face-to-face learning, how important it is not to lose accessibility gains along the way, and the possible cumulative effect of industrial action and COVID-related disruption. And I look at the crucial importance of student support services, including disability support and student advice, and how investing in those services can pay dividends in helping students through their studies, but also in de-escalating potential complaints and resolving them early. I look at the benefits a kinder approach to complaints can bring for students and providers, and also for our own case handlers. And I take a look forward at what the patterns of complaints might be this year and how we approach them.
Now, UKRI is out with a new five-year strategy. Sunday, talk us through it.
Okay, so UK Research Innovation has published its first five-year strategy, setting out objectives in six key areas. So it is people and careers, places, ideas, innovation, impact, and then UKRI as an organisation. And it's sort of broad aims of this is to enhance diversity and connectivity in the research ecosystem. So that's by fostering collaboration across disciplines, sectors, geographic location and basically developing and recognising a greater breadth of skills, then they're going to invest in five key themes. So net zero, health and wellbeing, infectious disease, security and resilience, and disparities in opportunities and outcome. And the idea of this is to leverage the UK's competitive advantage with like increased investment in innovation. There is a plan to sort of stimulate private investment in research and also achieve a 2.4% of GDP investment in research and development by 2027. I think that the important part of this, or to me, the important part is the sort of like flexibility and diversity of research careers. So the current system, obviously, they wrote in their strategy, has got two narrow measures of success and excellence, and does undervalue some skills that actually do contribute to sort of research more broadly. And I think that the cross-sector mobility is really important as well, because I was wondering how much this would interplay with the sort of current exodus of people leaving academia. You know, there's not really one day on Twitter where I don't see a sort of announcement of someone saying I'm leaving academia. So I think that, you know, a strategy that strengthens ties with other sectors, which, you know, these sort of really great minds might be going into, could be really good for the HE sector at large. Because I do sort of panic about the sector a little bit when I see these announcements almost every single day.
Fascinating, fascinating. Andy, I'm old enough to remember the NERSC review that led to the creation of UK Orion in the first place, and in 2015. And things have changed quite a bit since then, haven't they, in terms of how the government sees research and how it kind of treats science in particular.
Yeah, it has. And I think we should acknowledge straight off that the UKRI strategy isn't the same thing as the government strategy for R&D. And if we look at the spending settlement between now and the end of the parliament, which, as we know, is a pretty good one, the government now call the core research budget, which basically not everything that UKRI have got, but largely what UKRI control, i.e. the research councils, and the core research budget also includes QR money that's allocated. But that's 5.9 billion. And the government by 2024-25 will be spending 20 billion a year. So, you know, this isn't the first word or even the last word on what government wants to do with R&D. And that takes us a little bit back to the conversation about the Treasury and Rishi Sunak. Obviously, UKRI also control Innovate UK funding, which is going up quite significantly. But that sort of, you can't really get a grip on that in this strategy, or I struggle to sort of spot that. But the point being that, as Debbie writes in her blog on the site, that all of this stuff is coming from outside of UKRI, and this rather undermines the vision that Paul Nurse had for it. It isn't the only place. Its proportion of the overall spending is getting smaller, not bigger. Its importance as the strategic kind of home of what you do with R&D in the UK is less significant than it was when it was created. And government is happier to kind of dish out cash in the ways that it wants to dish out cash, either through things like ARIA or to individual government departments whose budgets are also increasing very significantly. And it all goes back to that point, you know, that point that Sunak made yesterday about wanting to catalyse business R&D and to grow the economy that way. And that really isn't, if it is in the strategy, it's buried very deeply within it. So again, I think the lesson for universities is don't, and the research communities, don't believe this is the only thing that matters, because it very clearly isn't.
I mean, isn't it a bit more than that, in that government is directing research and science policy in a much more direct way than Paul Nurse imagined they might when UKRI was set up. As much, UKRI now seems to be handing out a slice of that government spending. As you say, Andy, it's not, you know, it's a small slice compared to the overall pie. But is UKRI becoming more of a kind of more classic funding agency than what was imagined, which would be something much more organic that led the research community?
Yeah, so government is dictating where more of the R&D budget is being spent than it ever has, either as a proportion or as an overall amount. And UKRI's strategic position in that, I think, is somewhat, well, a long way short of that which Nurse envisaged. And I think the danger is that we don't appreciate that. We think UKRI and the funds that it sits above, alongside QR and the REF, we think that that is still what the government thinks about R&D, and it absolutely isn't. It's just the bit that we're most used to in universities. It's the bit that kind of, you know, people are promoted on the basis of, or that universities kind of get income largely from, when actually the government's agenda on R&D is much, much bigger and much more broader. And we're in danger, I think, of missing a lot of those boats as they sort of roll out over the next few years.
Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? And here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment that will not let it lie. This time I'm looking at the 2018-19 graduating cohort, taking the number that started at each provider on a foundation year in 2015-16 and plotting it against the proportion of UK graduates in full-time employment that agree or strongly agree that they were using the skills that they had learnt. This is all plotted, as usual, by provider. Is there a link between foundation years and skilled employment? Does it correlate?
I'm going to say it doesn't correlate because foundation year. My suspicion is that it's going to be people that are obviously the kind of entry profile people going into foundation years, the kinds of courses and universities that they tend to be at. I think there will be less of a link between. Generally between them and kind of labour market outcomes. So I'm going to say no.
I'm going to say yes. The reason I'm going to say that it does correlate is because students on foundation years, like in order to take a foundation year, you have to have made like a deliberate choice around what skills you do and don't have before you even embark on your degree. So I'm going to say that the applicant deliberation and decision making is more targeted towards their skills and educational outcome and then employment outcome. So I'm going to say that yes, it does correlate.
I'm going to say I don't know, but I like Andy, my first thought was it is going to be driven by the profile of the institutions and the courses that are offering a foundation year.
The answer is no, not even slightly. Indeed, the line is almost completely flat, suggesting that providers with a large number of students who start higher education with a foundation year are not likely to see any detriment from this in skilled graduate employment reports. Data is from the HESA student and HESA graduate outcomes collections, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
Happy are out with a social mobility index of universities. Jenny, talk us through it.
Yeah, so Professor David Phoenix has just published the second iteration of his English Social Mobility Index. So it's a metric. I suppose it's a new kind of ranking, really, based on what some people are calling the added value of a course. But David Phoenix rightly calls it the extent to which universities are enabling their students to achieve, because of course students are not passive in all of this. So it draws on things like the indices of multiple deprivation. It also looks at earnings a year after graduation. It looks at continuation rates. So it's actually quite a simple measure, but I think it's quite powerful. What was really surprising to me, and I'm sure to others, but quite encouraging, is the diversity of What was really surprising to me, but and I think to others as well, but very encouraging, was the diversity of institutions that made it to the top 10. So you might expect that it would be a particular type of institution, but actually there's three Russell Group universities there, 2 million plus institutions, and just in those top spots, a real mix of pre and post 92 institutions. So really challenging the idea that only certain parts of the sector can contribute to social mobility. And one of the findings I think that both Heppy and David Phoenix were keen to point out is that all universities are making a big contribution to social mobility. So What I hope this will do really is make social mobility feel more achievable for a wider range of institutions. I think it might help refine theories of change around access and participation, which have been very, very slowly evolving over the last 20 years.
I think one of the, because there was a lot of, so originally when the first sort of like metrics were used and brought out, there was a lot of discussion on social media around, and actually I think if I remember correctly that David Phoenix actually mentioned this in his sort of explainer blog. But it's the idea that I can't remember the exact term he used, but he said that it's a very difficult ask to talk about upward social mobility, because upward social mobility for some means that there's downward sociability. And I really hate the term downward social mobility, because downward social mobility does not have the same impact on individuals as upward social mobility. And there is this misconception that for disadvantaged students to do well, students with advantage have to become disadvantaged. But they're saying that on the basis that they don't go into a high paying graduate job. But that doesn't mean that they suddenly lose all the advantages that they had in life. Like, they, before they went to university, they still had family on a high income. They still had good social connections. And the idea that because someone from a disadvantaged background goes into a high paying graduate job, that someone who went to private school is suddenly living an impoverished life just is not true. And I really hate the conversation around it, especially when, you know, and I talk about this book a lot because it's a very good book and everyone should read it. But if you look at The Class Ceiling by Sam Friedman, that they talk about how students from advantaged backgrounds can go into university and get a 2-2, and they will still have like a very comfortable income compared to students from disadvantaged backgrounds on a first. And that isn't to do with the university, that's to do with all the connections that they had before they went to university. So I really think that we need to reframe this narrative away from where we're switching out rich students and poor students and all they're doing is switching places, because it's so much more complex than that. And it really does a disservice to all the great work that widening participation and social mobility does.
It does beg a lot of questions, doesn't it? Like, you know, is it a zero sum game? And, you know, what are we trying to achieve as a society? Are we trying to achieve sort of everyone rising to this mythical top, or are we looking at reducing wealth inequality? So there's a lot behind it, but it's actually, it is quite a good antidote to some of the traditional rankings that include things like how hard is it to get into this institution and so on. So it's, I think it does that very well.
Yeah, I think Jenny's right. I think what's quite nice about this is that normally, you know, you get your rankings and it's like, oh yeah, whatever. But this one is actually quite, you know, it's trying to do something different, and it does it, and it means we have a conversation about different types of institutions and different places, and I think that's quite healthy, and I think the value. Yeah, I mean, Sunday, you're absolutely right to unpack sort of what social mobility upwards and downwards really means. But because we know it's such a key objective of the government, it's quite nice to see a table like this and a ranking like this actually say, well, look, on your terms, look at what these different institutions do. And it's great to see Bradford and Aston and kind of Salford and Newman and others in the kind of top 10. And it's really, I mean, what I really like is that it forces us to have a conversation about place, because you know this shows what less fashionable I use that term guardedly, but places like Bradford, Wolverhampton, Bolton, Salford, you know Stoke, what levelling up essentially needs to mean in those places, and that we need to take that seriously, and the role of institutions like these there. But it also shows, and this is where levelling up and inequality meet, that there's a bunch of institutions right across the sector in London who are dealing with the effects of massive inequality in a very different type of economy and labour market, and they're dealing with it very successfully, whether it's Queen Mary or the LSE or or London South Bank or Brunel or Greenwich.
So I totally appreciate your point on, I think you mentioned sort of a handful of Midlands and Northern institutions, but you know, and their role in levelling up. But it, like, I do have to point out that regional levelling up impact is only felt if the institution, if the area retains the graduates. And we know that a lot of rural universities and campuses, they do have massive graduate hemorrhages. And I say hemorrhages if it's a bad term. They have a graduate exodus to, you know, to London, or up north it's to Manchester. And I think you're right. But like, obviously this isn't looking at graduates that stay in the locality. It's looking at graduate outcomes. We don't know where those graduates are, right? And I think one of the big issues with sort of like town gown divides, or like, you know, student when locals are not, you know, feel a resentment towards students, is this idea that students come, they gain all this knowledge and skills, and then they take it elsewhere, they take it to London. So I think we have to be really careful about looking at sort of the positive impacts on the individual students from an institution compared with the positive impacts for the region. Sorry.
But well, look, I agree, and you're right that the methodology here doesn't capture that. But you know, the particular institutions that are in the list, we do know from other data that whether it's Bradford or Wolverhampton or Teesside, that you know, they do retain much more of their graduates in the local area. Much more of their undergraduates come from the local area and then stay there afterwards. So I think we can apply a level of that beyond the methodology. And I think equally within London, that kind of inequality that I talk about within London and other parts of the southeast, we can apply it in a different way. You know, we know that London retains more of its graduates, but it's significant that the you know, that they're recruiting from areas of multiple deprivation and kind of taking people into those levels of income, albeit within the kind of London labour market. You know, that journey still matters. Yeah. So I think, you know, you're right, but we can use this to kind of illustrate a little bit more about what we know about those institutions and places.
No, that's a really good point. I like what you're saying about methodology, and what I actually liked about this report was more so than the content of the report was the way. Did you see the comparison columns where they showed social mobility index based on one methodology and then based on another? And I found that, because I'm sad, I found that really exciting, because I thought, like, this just demonstrates how sensitive our league tables are to the metrics that we put in, and those metrics are based on the values of the people constructing the league tables. And I was like, this is like obviously I'm interested in social mobility and I was interested in the data, but like, it was the methodology that they were using to create it and the way that they had shown their work in, and the way that the university shifted in the rankings, I thought that was fascinating.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to our website to find out more about our various subscriptions. So thanks to Sunday, Jenny, Andy and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen behind the scenes. Until next week, stay wonky.